swiped away right there by Xavier Simpson. He'll take it the other way. Three. Muhammad Ali up to a rock bomb. Knocked away, deflected by Charles Matthews. A turnover. Hey, they go for Matthews. Beautiful feed. And they get the flush. Matthews with a lot of size around him. Four on one. Simpson to the right.
Smart decision by Simpson.
And Simpson with the drive and the kick out. Abdur Rahman three.
Big basket. Great big basket.
Michigan with eight turnovers. Here comes Abdur Rahman into Buckner.
His first field goal.
Matthews step back triple.
Beautiful. Beautiful move and better patience by Matthews.
Simpson down court. Open Robinson. Abdur Rahman.
Fake. He faked Kofi out.
Three on two and off the side. Teske lingering.
Oh, nice fake. What a fake there by Matthews.
Simpson. Wow! A drive and a feed. Robinson three. Oh! That's all she wrote. Winning a school record 32nd game. Sends the Michigan Wolverines to the Final Four.
There's a false perception of Michigan that because we've got a bunch of kids that you love to like, it's easy to like. They're great kids, they're good students, so things that they're not tough. These dudes, they've been tough all year long. You don't go and win 13 games in the Big Ten, and you don't win four games in 4 days in the Garden if you're not tough. They call themselves pit bulls. So they had junkyard dogs. Pit bulls, we that was a little bit of the pregame speech, but we get into a fight, not a real fight, but a fight for a loose ball, that we were going to be like that. We had that dog in you that can get things done.
I feel like we all believe in one another, but I think that's the special thing about this group of guys. We don't really get caught up in the win streak that we're on. Like, most of the guys, we didn't even know, like, it was on a 13-game win streak. We just take everything one day at a time, and we stay connected through it all. So when you got guys like that who's truly your brothers, anything's possible.
Here's Custer, and goes up and over, May Lee. Both coaches going small quickly, and how about another three? Ben Richardson on the tip. There's the reverse layup by Ben Richardson. Jackson, yes, scores it around May Lee. Good pass, Kirkman. Towns finishes. Richardson, fire, and he hits it! And a chance at a four-point play. The one of Chicago has led most of this game is Kirkman on the catch and the finish. Beautiful pass down. Here's Custer, the catch, the shoot, it's good when you get to the Elite Eight. And look at Ingram with the left hand.
This is not something where it just started. These guys have been investing for a long time on how hard they worked, how hard they believed. You know, we've kind of had this mantra about the process. People ask me out there, they go, did you ever think you're going to the Final Four? And to be honest with you, it wasn't after Selection Sunday. We didn't say, hey, let's go to the Final Four. We said, all right, what do we got to do to beat Miami? Then it was the next game. And these guys have done an amazing job of just laser-like focus on what's right in front of them instead of skipping steps. But why not us? You have to have high-character guys that believe to really, truly, do that.
Be careful, San Antonio. The Ramblers are on their way, and I hope we continue. But we always do one game at a time. A young man said to me the other day, Sister Jean, we broke your bracket. And I said, keep breaking it. That's okay with me.
Here's the lob. Throws it high into the air, and Asabuki was waiting for it. Bounce pass, far corner. Trent with four. Off balance. Jayhawks down three. Don't have to get the three here.
No, go to the rim.
They're going to go for the three, though. That's a tie. A tie. Squares it at 72. Now it's Bagley. Gets around to the other side.
He just loves that right shoulder.
And that is going to do it. Kansas is still dancing and heading to San Antonio.
No matter what happened today, it was going to be disappointing if you don't win, but you're just proud to be a part of that game, proud to be a part of this. That's something that's bigger than just individuals. I mean, it's Kansas and Duke. We didn't even talk about going to Final Four. All we talked about was playing Duke. I do think playing Duke in that game helped us, playing a school of that caliber and program of that caliber. It was fun to be a part of that. I would be proud to have coached in that game, even if the outcome was different.
Welcome to the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Kind of thinking Bill Self likes the outcome just the way it is. Welcome to the Extravaganza right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. Where we are, Toledo's sports leader. Yeah, it would have been fun. I would have been honored. I would have been proud to coach in that game no matter how the outcome was. Well, Yeah, but I'm going to guess that you really, really like coaching it and winning and being on the way to the Final Four. Very interesting, by the way, that you heard the same comment. Jim Cushlin, did you notice that? The same comment from Porter Moses and from Bill Self.
Yeah, I did notice that.
Cinderella said, we were not thinking about the Final Four. We were not thinking about anything except beat Miami and then beat so-and-so. And then you heard Bill Self, Blue Blood. So Cinderella and Blue Blood, top seed. We weren't thinking about Final Four. We were thinking about playing Duke. That's it. Very, very similar mindsets for two different size schools with two very different backgrounds. Kansas, this is what, its 15th Final Four?
Yep.
This is Loyola Chicago's second Final Four. And, of course, their first one was highly successful because they won the national championship back in 1963, I believe it was.
Yep, that's correct.
So, yeah, very different schools, very different mindsets, very different histories, and very similar approaches, which is why they are two of the Final Four teams in a national semifinal showdown that just could not look more different. You have third-seeded Michigan rising up and winning its region, taking on 11th-seeded Cinderella, the Shockers from the South in Loyola. Take it south, meaning the bracket they're in, not that Chicago's in the south. against two blue blood number one seeds, Villanova coming out of the coming out of the east, and Kansas coming out of the Midwest. Each number one seed just riding along and rising along and cruising through their respective regions. How could it not? How could a tournament like this one not end up with an 11 seed in the Final Four, for crying out loud, when we had so many 7s and 9s and 5s in the Sweet 16, and we had 9s and 7s and 11s all in the Elite 8? How can we not have at least an 11 in the Final Four? And how could it not be Sister Jean's Loyola Chicago Ramblers that are going to be standing in the way of the Michigan Wolverines? Which begs this question, by the way. In Northwest Ohio and Southeast Michigan, anybody listening to the sound of our voices right now, what's your pleasure? Are you all in Cushland? I asked you about this. I kind of put you on the spot last week.
Yeah, I remember.
Because I said, you know, where are you on this? And you said, I'm Cinderella all the way. And I said, okay. I said, but, you know, there are Big Ten ties here. We are MAC and Big Ten basketball country, where we live and where we work and where we play. I said, what happens if we get down to the national semifinals and Michigan takes on the Ramblers? Where do your loyalties lie? Big Ten, Michigan, who, by the way, the last team standing from Michigan State, Ohio State, Purdue, simply incredible for John Beilein. Much more on that coming up after 3:35 with Anthony Broom of AmazingBrew.com. But I said, where are your loyalties going to lie? With Cinderella, the 11, you still want to see them move on to the national title game? Or Big Ten Michigan, Jim Cushlin? Where are you, Cushy Cush?
Well, I'm going to be in the minority of the nation, not necessarily the minority here, in being on Michigan's side. I would rather see the Big Ten, but that's more of a personal. But Michigan fans, if you haven't sensed this one already, you are the enemy on Saturday, because I know the rest of the nation would love to see it be the Ramblers.
I'm sure most of the rest of the nation would. I was about to deliver a beating. I had it all loaded up for you and everything. I thought you were going to... I thought you were going to go away from the locality and the geography and the Big Ten loyalty that we have here and go with the Ramblers and Sister Jean. I thought maybe religion or something had reached you there, but no, you're going to go with the Wolverines.
No, I feel I should go with the Big Ten. I mean, you know, they're a team that we cover. Our sister station is the local affiliate for your Wolverines around here. And this is really, regardless of who their opponents have been, the fact that the Michigan is, you know, still here in a Final Four really should tell you something about Beilein and this program. And I know we're going to get to more of that. But when Michigan's game went final, it's like, okay, now you got Michigan against Loyola. And I very much remember saying last week when we were talking about this that I would love to see it be Loyola. And I had to think for a few minutes.
You still can't say Loyola, can you?
I guess I don't know why I can't say it right.
You know, I was talking to somebody else today on the radio this morning that I was doing an interview with who couldn't say it either. She just kept stumbling. You just don't bother trying to say Loy. You just say lie. You just say Loyola and just run with it. It's so funny. I didn't know that was that hard of a word. I didn't know it was such a tongue twister.
Well, I will at least give myself credit for running with it and not getting my tongue twisted like you were describing.
Loyola. Loy. Say Loy.
Loy.
Ola.
Ola.
Loy.
Loy.
Ola.
Ola.
Loyola.
Loyola.
Oh, my.
I had to do that just to mess with you right
okay.
there.
Okay. You're such an idiot. Okay. Something else we talked about with respect to this, Jim. Last week as we were, not lamenting. I don't think anybody was complaining about all of the low seeds. I mean, I asked the question. I didn't make a statement or issue a condemnation or a complaint of the way the tournament was running. When I said that, when I asked that, is it good for college basketball to have this many quote unquote low seed Cinderellas around at this level, at the Elite Eight? This many nines and 11s and really low seed teams up there mixing in with the Blue Bloods. And, or is that great for college basketball? Because, everybody loves the upstart. Everybody loves the underdog. Everybody loves to rise up and see the little guys beat the big guys. But when there's so many little guys doing it, is it just annoying? And, you're like, hey, I'd be a lot more dialed in with for example, I'm quite certain there were a lot more people tuned in yesterday for, Duke, number one, Kansas, and number two, Duke, those Blue Bloods, than probably tuned in for, even the Michigan-Florida State game, let alone the Loyola-Kansas State game, right? And we were trying to define what Blue Blood meant, and I asked you if Gonzaga early in the when the Sweet 16, if Gonzaga had reached Blue Blood status based on their constant presence in the Sweet 16. I mean, it's become almost an automatic thing these days. And then I asked you, is Michigan a Blue Blood? And we pondered it for quite a while, coming up with a lot of really interesting reasons and arguments in favor of and against, because it's primarily a football school. And how about this? I don't know if you saw this today yet, Jim, but in ESPN.com, as part of their tournament coverage, article by Andrea Adelson, headline, Three Blue Bloods, a Miracle, and the Final Four No One Saw Coming. What happens when a nun, her nouveau team, and three Blue Bloods make their way to the Final Four in San Antonio? You get a field that's a little bit expected and a little bit holy now. So she's calling, ESPN.com, by extension, is calling Villanova, Kansas, and Michigan all basketball Blue Bloods. Kush, what do you think?
I have to agree with the Kansas and the Villanova part. I'm still not sure, though. I mean, I get why the writer is calling it that way. It probably helps add to whatever he's trying to say later on.
That's right.
Either way, it's it's three big time powers type schools against Loyola Chicago.
There you go. You got it.
And I'm still not sure if I'd say that Michigan, is a Blue Blood. I will say this, and we'll have to wait till, probably Tuesday or Wednesday, or Monday or Tuesday or so of next week. But that whole test is, really going to come into focus with the two Final Four games. And
what do you mean? Are you saying that Michigan has to win to be considered Blue Blood? They have to beat Loyola?
No, I'm talking about the part of people paying attention thing that you were mentioning a moment ago, which you also mentioned a few times last week. My bold prediction, I think Loyola Chicago Michigan gets better ratings than Villanova Kansas next weekend.
Well, in my defense, Jim, I didn't play it out to the Final Four.
Right.
I think the Final Four will always draw because it's the Final Four.
True.
It's champ, semifinal Saturday and championship Monday. I feel like even if it's two relative upstarts that meet in one of the semifinals in the college football playoff Final Four, it's going to draw massive numbers just because it's the Final Four. And in college football's place, it's the only four,
Right.
So I don't know if this is going to be as much of a two things, actually, I'll say. I don't know if this will be as much of a story that I was talking about at the Sweet 16 level and at the Elite 8 level in terms of attention, ratings, how many people care to watch, that sort of thing when you're talking about non-traditional basketball powers, non-traditional Florida State, Kansas State, even to that degree. And I've got to sit here and look back at the rest of the other Sweet 16 and Elite 8 games, but you understand my point. So
yeah.
I was talking about earlier rounds still, even though it was Sweet 16 and Elite 8. Final Four is a different animal altogether. All of the games are just in the one day because there's only the two.
Mm-hmm.
It's not spread out over 4 days as we just completed with Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday.
Right.
where there's gaps and people have to decide, is it appointment viewing for me or not? It is appointment viewing because this is just the Final Four, and it's all in one day. They're back-to-back, 6 o'clock on Saturday and then 8 o'clock, and I'm fudging with the minutes because it's like, what, 6:09 and 8 and
yeah,
eight,
like 8:49 or something.
Yeah, something stupid. So we'll just say 6 and 8.
Yeah.
So it's 6 and 8 primetime Saturday night. People are going to pack the bars, and they're going to watch Final Four, and it doesn't matter who's in it. Secondly, I would defend myself in this way. We no longer have a multitude of Cinderellas where it's yawn time because I got it, this 9 against that 9 or this 9 against that 11 or this 7 against that 11 or whatever the case might be. It really is what ESPN.com said here when they said three blue bloods. We can debate the definition of blue blood for Michigan again if we must, but ESPN.com has decided no. Michigan is a blue blood, so you got three prominent powers and one Cinderella. And this is the kind of thing that March Madness and championship basketball loves. Not multiple Cinderellas, one Cinderella making it all the way to the Final Four. Now, if you are just somebody that likes to see the upstarts, that likes to see Rocky rise up and knock out Apollo, then you are all about Loyola of Chicago. And if you aren't, if you've got just your, you know, your, these are my favorite teams, you know, I like seeing, I'm an ACC fan, or I'm a Big East fan, or I'm a Big Ten fan, or whatever, you got your representative there too, and you're ready to rock with them. So to me, there's only one Cinderella now, so that evens things out, and B, we are in the Final Four, and that's a very different animal than the Elite Eight and the Sweet 16. Even though you would think that those are still rising, they are, but like I said, this is the Final Four, and I don't care if you had, you know, Arkansas Tech. There is no Arkansas Tech, right? Arkansas
Tech. There's an Arkansas State, but not
an Arkansas
Tech.
There's an Arkansas State. That's why I went with Tech. I'm trying to make the point of you could have Arkansas Tech against Owens. We talked about community colleges in the Final Four, and still people are going to lock in because it's the Final freaking Four.
You know, that's such a good point about the Final Four part, and I hadn't, you know, considered that. Now between today and the end of tomorrow, I'm going to try to keep an eye on, see if they've announced any ratings for Sweet 16, you know, yeah, or Elite Eight games to help. Because I'd love to know, because that was a fascinating discussion I thought we had. You know, which would you rather tune into, you know, at those type of rounds, the Blue Bloods or the Cinderella? It's a very fun topic. There's not really a wrong answer necessarily, but I don't know what the answer would be. And so I'll have to check that. As soon as I can find some info, I'll let you know.
See, now, in the Final Four, as I said, since there's only two, it's my belief that both games will get great ratings on Saturday. However, I would say this. If I had to pick only one, you know, if I had to work and my, you know, put in overtime, put in an extra 2 hours for the boss, no matter what my job is on Saturday night, and I could pick the 6-8 shift or the 8-10 shift. I'd probably rather watch Michigan and Loyola for the locality, geographical factor of Michigan and being Big Ten country, as well as MAC country, of course. But I would have to see that again, as well as the.
Well, here you go. Actually, I just found something. This is the site Sports Media Watch on some of the Sweet 16 ratings, just for random purposes. Yeah. Kansas State, Kentucky. Back on, I think that was Thursday. Yeah, Thursday. That had a 5 rating, 8.3 million. As I scan down, Loyola Chicago, Nevada, 4.4, 7.06 million.
There you go. That's exactly
okay,
what
there
I
we
mean.
Go, yeah.
Kentucky Blue Blood versus two Cinderellas. People were a little less interested in the two Cinderellas. But now, I watch and see here. Now, I'm not saying, again, because it's a Final Four, everybody will watch both. But back to what I was trying to say, if I had to work, I would say, let me work the late shift. I want to watch the Michigan-Loyola game because it's Cinderella versus our locality and Big Ten favorite here. Rather than the Blue Blood matchup, only because I know whoever comes out of Kansas and Villanova is going to be a prohibitive favorite over whoever comes out of the other one in the final, and I'll get to see them down the line. But I'll only get a chance to see Cinderella and Michigan, you know, in that one chance. Now, I'll watch both, but if I had to pick one or the other, I would pick the first game to see, and I think the ratings would reflect that more then on Final Four Saturday than it would as you just looked up in the Sweet 16.
Yeah, and as I'm scanning through this, you want to take a guess which of the Sweet 16 games was the least rated?
Read them to me because I don't have them all memorized.
We have Kansas State, Kentucky, which I just mentioned.
Yeah.
Loyola, Chicago, Nevada, mentioned.
Yeah.
And we have Michigan A&M, Florida State, Gonzaga, Syracuse, Duke, Clemson, Kansas, Purdue, Texas Tech, and the last one was Villanova, West Virginia.
For some reason, I want to say Purdue, Texas Tech.
Florida State Gonzaga was the least watched Sweet 16 game this year.
That was my second because of the small population in the locale up there in Spokane with Gonzaga. You know, because obviously the biggest ratings areas are going to be the schools themselves. And, you know, it's just not that big of a school with that big of a following even up there. So
yeah.
I kind of thought that one might be low.
Michigan with, A&M was the second least viewed Sweet 16 game.
Where was the Purdue matchup then?
The Purdue. Let me see if I can find it.
If you don't have it, it's okay.
But it is not listed in here, so it must be sandwiched in the middle of all this.
Okay, so it's somewhere in the middle. Okay, that's good. I have no complaints about any of those. Those make some sense to me. But as I said, you know, the non-blue bloods, the teams that are Cinderella playing a blue blood people like to watch. But if it's two Cinderellas going against one another, as you pointed out, with Nevada and Loyola, then maybe not quite as much. Okay, really, really good stuff there. We have a lot to talk about the tournament. We have much more today, by the way, too. NFL owners meetings are getting ready this week. A lot of big information coming out there. Promises of fixing the catch problem, the catch rule. And also, excuse me, I'm trying to fight off a sneeze before we get to our wild stat. Also they're going to discuss the national anthem issue and protesting. And apparently the owners are arriving at the meeting ready to battle. That's right. There are some who say let the protests go on, others saying put this crap to bed. The anthem is not a place for protesting. It is a place to get ready for football. That's it. So I want to hit that today. Talk a little bit about also the pass interference rule, something they're going to discuss. Should it continue to be a spot foul or should it be just a college-style 15-yard penalty? I hate that idea. Going to get into that. Baseball starts, obviously, this week, so we're going to talk a little bit about that, too. So we have a lot of ground to cover over the course of the next now 90 minutes. We're glad you're with us right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. We got a Sports Center coming up after we get wild.
ESPN 106.5 The Ticket presents The Wild Stat of the Day, brought to you by Buffalo Wild Wings, Wings, Beer, Sports.
Buffalo Wild Wings Wild Stat of the Day for today, all tournament-related stats. Cushling seems to think the Wild Stat of the Day means a list of stats. He continues to give me a list of stats rather than picking one that is wilder than the others. So here we go. This today's paragraph. Kansas's OT win against Duke might be a bad sign. They're the 10th team ever to win their Elite Eight game in overtime. 7 of the previous 9 lose in the Final Four. None of them have won the championship. That could be a wild stat enough right there. But Cushling goes on. This is also the Jayhawks' 15th Final Four, more than the other three this season combined. Michigan has been there 6 times, Villanova 5, Loyola 2. For Michigan, they now have 32 wins on the season, most in program history. And if they advance to the championship game Monday, they will be the first to ever get there without having played a team seeded 1-5 since the seeding began back in 1979. There you have it, your Buffalo cadre of stats.
I even left one out.
Oh, God. What do you got?
Duke losing in overtime. That's only the 3rd overtime game in the tournament Duke has ever played. The other two, Christian Laettner buzzer beater for wins.
Wow, how about that? Very interesting stuff. Those are your Buffalo Wild Wings Wild Stats of the Day right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. Back after this.
Extravaganza, ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
There's a false perception of Michigan that because we got a bunch of kids that you love to like, it's easy to like. They're great kids, they're good students, all things, that they're not tough. These dudes, they've been tough all year long. You don't go and win 13 games in the Big Ten, and you don't win 4 games in 4 days in the Garden if you're not tough.
Yeah, that's a very good point, no question about it. Rolling onward, it's 3:40 on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket, where we are, Toledo Sports Leader. We got to figure this out now. This has been working for a while now. We talked to Anthony Broom of MazeAndBrew.com, I believe, during the Wolverines' 9-game winning streak to wrap the regular season. We talked to him during the Big Ten tournament, which they cruised through at Madison Square Garden, and we've talked to him at almost every level of this tournament thus far. So why the hell not bring Anthony Broom right back here, and let's enjoy the Wolverines' run now to and maybe through the Final Four. Anthony, thanks for being back with us. How are you?
I'm doing great. You know, at this point, why the hell not is kind of like, it kind of feels like my mantra with all this. So, yeah, here we are once again. It's, hopefully it's good luck for them.
Yeah, no question about it. I mean, we've certainly enjoyed having you on, and boy, it seems like every time we talk, and you know, hey, maybe we'll talk again. We sure get the opportunity to, and not on a retrospective of the season that has ended, but one that does continue to roll on. Can you? I mean, you know, again, this is a team that had obviously a very good season. They now have had a school record number of victories. So, you know, this is not to say that, you know, this has been a mediocre season. But as we had talked about, you know, Michigan State was the best team in the conference. And then, well, maybe Purdue is the best team in the conference. And maybe for a hot minute, Ohio State was viewed as the best team in the conference. I don't know, and you tell me if I'm wrong, Anthony, and I'm speaking not of you and the folks at Mason Brew, but if nationally, if anybody at any point this season said, you know, Michigan might be the best team in the conference until right now.
I don't think anyone, I mean, no one on my site said it. I didn't say it. I don't think any of my guys said it. You know, and obviously when they beat Michigan State that first time in East Lansing, I mean, there's always the trolling that kind of goes on and things like that, but I don't think there was a level-headed person out there that could still say, you know, well, this Michigan team is better than, you know, this, you know, this is Tom Izzo's best team, and, you know, they still have, you know, they'll be fine in March and all that. So I'm not sure there was a level-headed person going through the Big Ten season who was like, you know what, this may be the best team in the Big Ten. But they just kind of, after that Northwestern game, they peaked from there. You know, they've played their best basketball. They haven't lost since then. So it's one of those things where I guess you'd rather get hot than have the hype early on. But, you know, other than that, I mean, obviously the eyeball test says something very different when we're having that conversation now. And then Michigan is still playing, and none of those other teams are. So I guess it just kind of speaks for itself.
No question about it. It really does. It's just, you know, it's amazing. There might have been the chance and the potential for that to be the case, but nobody thought so. And it really wasn't until maybe when they rolled and got Michigan State and Purdue back-to-back in the conference championship semifinals and tournament championship game, you know, and they beat them each relatively comfortably before you realize, you know, this team is pretty doggone good. And then, of course, they had an ugly, sluggish win against Montana, you know, the buzzer beater with Jordan Poole against Houston, and then, you know, taking apart A&M and then just surviving and advancing is the best way to describe Florida State. I mean, here we are. I mean, they've done it, really. Have they not? In a variety of ways. You have to be able to win a lot of different kinds of games. Track meets, slugfests, you know, high pace, slow pace, fast pace, slow pace. And they've done it every single way that you can.
Yeah, and I think that kind of speaks for itself, too. I mean, I've said it ad nauseum on here with you. You know, it's been a team in the past where it's kind of been a live by the three, die by the three type thing. But, you know, in three out of the four games they've played in the tournament, you can make the argument there, you know, there've been three of the worst offensive performances they've had all year, but those are all three wins. And then we saw what happens when things are firing on all cylinders. And, you know, they sent a team out of LA in Texas A&M running out, you know, with their tail between their legs. So it's one of those deals where, you know, I think this is a team, a resilient group that has seen it all, especially like the seniors on the team, you know, some of the more experienced guys. They've been dealt everything, not just this year, but a lot of the guys that were on the team last year as well. So, you know, they are prepared for every single scenario, and that's just not a mark of the experience they have. That's, you know, a testament to the coaching that they've received as well. It's, you know, I'm not sure that there is, you know, pound for pound, a better coach in college basketball right now than what John Beilein is doing in Michigan.
John Beilein said after the win against Florida State, and speaking of the obvious, I think anybody who watched and listened to that game, and I caught a lot of it on the radio because I was not in front of the screen, and you could hear that it was like Ann Arbor West. Beilein even said it felt like we were in Ann Arbor. I mean, you talk about traveling, either that or there are just tons of Michigan fans who live in Los Angeles. I don't know. I'm going to guess not. But what does that say about the momentum that this team is playing with? I mean, you know, the entire Ann Arbor community and obviously a ton of the student body and fans and alums all made their way to L.A. and they're going to make their way to San Antonio because it was really almost a hostile environment for Florida State, who obviously acquitted themselves quite well, all things considered.
Yeah, that was really jarring to me. And I don't want to say I was surprised by it because, you know, it's, to me, the Block M and things like that, you know, that's one of those, that's one of those iconic sort of brands in sports, right up there with, you know, the Yankees logo, the Red Sox logo, the Lakers logo, you know, the Old English D, the winged wheel. So, you know, they have, you know, they're one of the better universities in the world, so they have a pretty wide alumni base. But, you know, it's one of those things where I think even with the basketball team, maybe even a little bit more so than football, I think obviously basketball isn't as big of a sport and a following in Ann Arbor, but I think that that core, that niche of the Michigan basketball fan base that is willing to travel will go wherever they play, whether it's, you know, Mars or LA or San Antonio this weekend. So, you know, I think that's really cool. And like I said, it was, you know, I had been to some of those non-conference games at Chrysler. It wasn't very loud for that. And I'd been to the bigger games, you know, the Purdue game, the Ohio State game this past year. I'm not sure Chrysler was as loud as it was in Staples Center, the last couple of days.
Wow.
So that's a testament to, and that's a great environment at Chrysler too, but that's a testament to, you know, how people traveled and just kind of the stage that they were on.
Yeah, no question about it. We're talking to Anthony Broom, AmazingBrew.com. By the way, and this is a totally off the subject statement, but, you know, a lot of people who don't think that they can expand the college football playoff because they don't think that fans will travel to multiple places to watch their teams play. Yeah, well, look at this Michigan team and look at the way they're traveling all over the freaking country on this odyssey in March Madness to win six times, for crying out loud, potentially, and play six times. Yeah, they can add another round in college football. Fans will travel, make no mistake about it. Now, back on track here. Why were buckets so hard to come by against Florida State? Is it a Florida State thing? Was it a Michigan thing? Was it a combination where both teams said we're going to lock in on D and we're not going to run? When you score, I don't know, roughly half as many points as you did in the round of 16 against A&M, you know, something changed, and a lot of it looked difficult. You know, it wasn't just a, you know, great lockdown Florida State thing to me, but it just looked like, you know, they had a hard time getting into a rhythm offensively in a lot of possessions. Fortunately, late, they got just the right, you know, the ball in the right spot at the right time. They hit a big three. Wagner had a couple of big plays inside. But why does it seem like sometimes buckets are so hard to come by for this team?
Well, the thing that I think a lot of people, you know, a lot of people say number nine Florida or ninth seeded Florida State, and they see that Michigan sort of struggles, and they go, well, what's the deal with that? But, you know, when I look at what Florida State brings to the table, that's a team that's, you know, athletic, they're quick. You know, those are the kind of teams that give Michigan, I won't say trouble, but that they have, I mean, they did have trouble with them. It was hard fought. It's hard fought a game as they've played all year. So I think the length, the athleticism, I think in a lot of ways, Florida State was able to do what I thought Texas A&M would be able to do, in terms of, you know, getting their guys out and running and, you know, closing off the 3-point line and things like that. But, It's like we've talked about, you know, it's not, this team can win when their offense isn't working. And the biggest, they won that game with defense, which is not something we've been able to say about Michigan basketball a whole heck of a lot before this season. And that was the textbook, you have to win on that end of the floor game. And they were able to do that. And I think, you know, you give all the credit in the world to Leonard Hamilton and, off topic, I have no idea why they didn't foul, only down four with like 15 seconds to play. I thought that was silly.
Well, you know, I was going to ask you about that anyway, and also Leonard Hamilton's post-game remarks to Dana Jacobson. So let me lead into it with the other part of the question. Because of the way Michigan shoots free throws as a team and because of Xavier Simpson, I guess I'm going to try to combine these two questions about, I was really afraid, you know, the announcers made a big deal of pointing out Xavier Simpson's only a 50% free throw shooter. And he's the point guard, and the ball's going to be in his hands. The more they talked about it, the more I thought, oh, my God, Xavier is going to shoot them out of the Final Four. They're going to keep sending him to the line. He's going to have one of two or none of two or miss the front end of one-on-ones. And, you know, and Florida State's going to come back here. And fortunately, they got the ball to a couple of better foul shooters, and they did hit a couple. But my point to that is, I cannot understand, and go ahead and give me your thoughts on why they did not do so when they were down four with 11 seconds left after the last Michigan free throws. And then B, going forward against Loyola, and if they are fortunate enough to get into the national championship game, how crucial, you know how these games can come down to it, how crucial will that be? You know, if Xavier is on the court and if some of the other guys who are not necessarily lighting it up from the foul line, you know, in a game of inches, in a game of free throws, in a game where every single point matters, that can be a very, very dangerous thing.
Yeah, well, let me say this. I have no idea what Florida State was doing. I don't know why they didn't foul. I don't know why the decision was made not to foul, other than maybe, I mean, essentially that was conceding defeat after you kind of, you know, been punched in the mouth for, you know, 39-plus minutes of basketball. So I don't know if that was an element to it. It certainly seemed like that when Hamilton did his post-game interview.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I mean, we complain about how the last minute or two of
astounded.
Basketball game.
I'm sorry, real quick. He looked like, what are you talking about? You know what I mean? He looked at Dana Jacobson like he didn't know what the score was. He looked at her like he didn't know how many seconds were left. He made it seem like they were down 9 with the final 5 seconds of the game, and so they let Michigan dribble it out. It was nowhere near that. I swear, he acted like he just did not know the situation in any way, shape, or form. I was blown away by his...
Well, and
go ahead.
And you know what? I just thought of this right now. Like, maybe that was a poor job of scouting on their part. Maybe you think, oh, Michigan's a team that, you know, can shoot from any place in the gym, so, you know, their guys would be good from the free throw line, too. So maybe that was an assumption made on his part. Mm-hmm. Like I said, I have no idea. Like, his reaction to her question was as if, you know, they were down by 11 or something like that. It didn't make any sense to me. But like I said, we talk as fans all the time about, oh, these games, you know, the end of these games are brutal. It takes 20 minutes to play the last 2 minutes of the game, yada, 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 things like that. But, you know, as a coach, how do you not extend that game when you're playing against, I think what the stats said was the 321st ranked free throw shooting team in the country out of 355? It makes no sense at all.
No, it
so
really doesn't.
I have no idea.
And to that end, guys, they missed a few free throws there, you know, at the end, and it wasn't the one that Florida State was going to foul. Rockman missed one.
Missed two.
Yeah,
he missed
that's
two
right.
Front
right.
Ends.
Two.
No, wait a minute. I think he missed. Now I got to go back.
No, he missed the back end and
missed
front
the front end.
End.
Did Simpson miss a front end?
Yes.
And then Rockman missed a back end and then the next front end.
And then
so
the next, yep.
Three of those four, yeah, is what had happened there. Go ahead, Jim.
And for perspective, too, I mean, you know, this is part of it, and it certainly won't do it justice because you can't see the facial expressions, obviously, as a radio, but one more time.
Coach, take me through the final seconds of this game. Why didn't you guys foul?
What are you talking about?
Down the stretch there, the end of the game, the final seconds, 11 seconds left on the clock.
Do you think that the game came down to the final seconds of the game?
I'm asking, yes. Though, why that decision in the final seconds of the game?
The game was over.
Right? I mean, guys, and we'll get to Anthony here. I mean, I don't know how this can be, how your assistant coaches don't let you know, coach, we're down four. We're just down four. There's 11 seconds after they made their last basket or last free throw. There's 11 seconds. We're down four. Foul. I mean, if they miss, you know, the next front end, we come down, we get a quick three and foul again. You know, we're only down a bucket or, you know, down by a point. Even if they split their two, because they were over 10 fouls that time, so there was no more one-on-one. They were going to get two. But even if they split it, okay, we're down five. We come down and get a bucket. We get another foul, and they miss the next one. We get a shot. At least a shot. It's long. You know, the odds are long, but we got a shot here. How are their assistant coaches not talking to Leonard? They did not seem to know the circumstances of the game at that point, Anthony.
Yeah, it's either they didn't realize that they were only down four, but, you know, again, I saw the interview live when it happened, but even just listening to the clip right now, that just sounds like a man that was defeated by a slugfest of a basketball game. I don't know, but if I'm a player of his, I'd be pissed because I feel like that, you know, we see these this tournament has produced so many crazy moments already, and your coach took your opportunity to have one of those moments out of your hands by either a lack of awareness or straight up giving up on you, which I don't know which one's worse, but either way, I mean, it is what it is at this point.
And let's not mistake, guys. It's not like that decision truly cost Florida State the game, but it's still a head scratcher. And
no, it didn't. You're right, but it cost them a chance to extend
absolutely.
The game.
Yes, absolutely.
You know, the final four appearances don't grow on trees, do they? I mean, these are rare.
I think Florida State has one, and that was in like 1972 or something ridiculously far back.
Yeah, it's bizarre,
15 seconds of basketball is like two commercial breaks for CBS. So it's like that's a lot of time.
That's a lot of time, and anything can happen, especially when you do have, as you pointed out, maybe they didn't scout it very well, but Michigan is not as a team, a great free throw shooting team. So anyway, moving on now, just to talk about some of the struggles as I mentioned offensively. Talk about Wagner. He played the entire first half, I think, without a field goal. He did have 5 free throws. He came on in the second half. He got down low. He couldn't shoot outside. Very, very few guys could in that game for Michigan, obviously, but he started to make some big time plays, and even when he had to go to the bench with his fourth foul, another big comes in and really makes some big time impact there. Do they have enough depth do you think to finish this job, Anthony Broome?
I think they do. I think, you know, I don't – Wagner, to me, I think he's sort of gotten his own way on Saturday. I think he was a little too charged up, a little – and then maybe a little caught off guard when he saw, you know, how good Florida State is. Again, I think we – this time of year we get caught up in records and seeds and things like that. Florida State's a good team. It's a very athletic team. And I think that maybe he was just a little too charged up, and that's kind of why he didn't play well.
And when you are overly amped up, what does it affect the most? And for me, it affects outside shooting, because when you're just gripping it too tight, your muscles are a little bit too tense and everything else, you're all amped up, you can't get into that rhythm and flow of your nice smooth jumper. And I think that's why he was 0 for 7 from 3. I think that's why as a team, you know, they were 4 for 22. I mean, you know, if you're amped up and you go to the rack, you go hard. I mean, it can help you, actually. It can help you play defense. It can help you get into people's faces. But we need to settle in, get a nice smooth flow going, and get your jumper going. It's hard to do when you're a little bit overly charged up.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And even at times this year when he's gotten a foul trouble early or been a little erratic early on, they've been able to go to John Teske for some good minutes. I won't say they're great, but I think Teske certainly could have played better on Saturday. But, you know, I think they are deep enough. You know, you have guys that can come off the bench in Jordan Poole, in John Teske. Duncan Robinson right off the bat. You know, you get him to 6 points, Michigan's undefeated this year. So it's one of those things where I think they have the guys there. And even, you know, Jerron Simmons is the guy who's come off kind of down the stretch and given them some nice minutes at point guard coming off the bench. So I think they're deep enough. I actually think when it's all said and done, this is probably one of the deeper teams that John Beilein has had at Michigan. So when we're talking about depth and things like that, I'm not really concerned about that, but yeah, if Wagner is in foul trouble early or, you know, is kind of not there early on, I there's a little bit of pause with John Teske. He's either going to, you know, play like he did Saturday or play a little bit better, or he'll play like he did that game against Purdue in the Big Ten tournament where he absolutely went off. So,
well, yeah, he only had 12 minutes in the game on Saturday, but he did grab a couple of crucial rebounds with Wagner down and then, of course, ran the floor like a big needs to, and took that pass from Simpson late for one of their last field goals, you know, on a break. Simpson kind of looked left and dumped it right to Teske, and he finished. And so, yeah, I mean, you know, he wasn't spectacular, but he made some big plays when he had to with Wagner being down, which is kind of what prompted the question. Very briefly, because we're short on time here, Anthony Broome of MazeandBrew.com, but you've been watching Loyola like everybody else, the Cinderella slipper and Sister Jean story aside. What about the basketball matchup? If it's just basketball and not the fairy dust in the air story here, how do you like the matchup?
Yeah, you know, I look at this Loyola team, and what I see is, yeah, they are an 11th seed. It's a great story, and it's a Cinderella and things like that. But, you know, when I look at that team, I see a team that they're 32-5 right now. They've been very good all year, and they were maybe even underseeded coming into this tournament. So this is not a team that is, you know, they've had a little bit of March magic getting there. I know a couple of those wins were 1-point wins or 2-point wins to get here, but, you know, they shoot well from outside. I think they're coached extremely well, and they just have that it factor. So if I'm Michigan, I'm not coming into this game thinking that they have it easy, and they don't feel that way. And, you know, I don't think Michigan fans even feel that way. Anyone who's watched this team play knows that they can hang with anyone, the way that they shoot and how well coached they are. So, I think this is I'm not all that worried about the matchup for Michigan. I would, you know, not to look ahead, but I would be certainly a lot more worried about what could potentially be coming on Monday night. But you don't get to Monday night until you win on Saturday. So, basketball-wise.
That's exactly right. You know what, I'll tell you what, Anthony, because we're short on time here. Let me interrupt you there just to say we'd love to have you back Friday if you can to give a more in-depth preview of the actual matchup there. And while you're at it, do some homework on Villanova and Kansas, the one versus the one on the other side, and kind of get a prediction for Monday night on how this thing is going to – I mean, you know, who's going to get to Monday night and how Saturday's games are going to go. We'd love to have you back, Anthony. Sound all right?
Sounds good to me.
Thank you, Anthony Broome, MazeandBrew.com. Make sure you read and follow that outstanding Wolverines website. And a reminder for you, if you need a new roof, $1 down. You need new siding, $1 down. You need new windows, $1 down. You can get a new look, your choice of roof, siding, or windows for $1 down for your home. That's the power of 7 years interest-free. That's right. Don't delay. Call WeatherSeal today. Get the roof, the siding, the windows you've always wanted for just $1 down. 877-WINDOWS is the number to call. Call WeatherSeal today at 1-877-WINDOWS. And check them out online if you want more information. It's weathersealhomeservices.com. All right, we're going to get a top-of-the-hour local sports center. We have a lot more to talk about the tournament coming up. And also, NFL owners' meetings are this week, and there are already some big storylines coming out in advance of them. We'll talk about that as we continue. Hour number two of the extravaganza coming right up.
Swiped away right there by Xavier Simpson. He'll take it the other way. Three. Muhammad Ali Abdul-Rahman. Knocked away, deflected by Charles Matthews. A turnover. They go for Matthews. Beautiful feed. And they get the flush. Matthews with a lot of size around him. Four on one. Simpson to the right.
Smart decision by Simpson.
And Simpson with the drive and the kick out. Abdul-Rahman three.
Big basket. Big, big basket.
Michigan with eight turnovers. Here comes Abdul-Rahman into Buckner.
His first field goal.
Matthews step back triple.
Beautiful. Beautiful move and better patience by Matthews.
Simpson down court. Open Robinson. Abdul-Rahman.
Oh, what a fake. Two fake Kobe around.
Three on two and off the side. Teske lingering.
Oh, nice fake. Oh, what a fake there by Matthews.
Simpson. Wow! A drive and a feed. Robinson three. Oh! That's all she wrote. Winning a school record 32nd game sends the Michigan Wolverines to the Final Four.
There's a false perception of Michigan that because we got a bunch of kids that you love to like, it's easy to like. They're great kids, they're good students, so things that they're not tough. These dudes, they've been tough all year long. You don't go and win 13 games in the Big Ten, and you don't win four games in 4 days in the Garden if you're not tough. They call themselves pit bulls. So they had junkyard dogs. Pit bulls, that was a little bit of the pregame speech, but we get into a fight, not a real fight, but a fight for a loose ball, that we were going to be like that. We had that dog in you that can get things done.
I feel like we all believe in one another, but I think that's the special thing about this group of guys. We don't really get caught up in the win streak that we're on. Like, most of the guys, we didn't even know, like, it was on a 13-game win streak. We just take everything one day at a time, and we stay connected through it all. So when you got guys like that who's truly your brothers, anything's possible.
Jackson, yes, scores it around Mayween. Good pass, Kirkman. Towns finishes. Richardson, fire, and he hits it. And a chance at a four-point play.
Loyola Chicago has led most of this game. It's Kirkman on the catch and the finish. Beautiful pass, Towns. Here's Custer, the catch, the shoot. It's good. When you get to the Elite Eight, and look at Ingram with the left hand.
This is not something where it just started. These guys have been investing for a long time on how hard they worked, how hard they believed. You know, we've kind of had this mantra about the process. People ask me out there, they go, did you ever think you're going to the Final Four? And to be honest with you, it wasn't after Selection Sunday. We didn't say, hey, let's go to the Final Four. We said, all right, what do we got to do to beat Miami? Then it was the next game. And these guys have done an amazing job of just laser-like focus on what's right in front of them instead of skipping steps. But why not us? You have to have high-character guys that believe to really, truly, to truly do that.
Be careful, San Antonio. The Ramblers are on their way, and I hope we continue. But we always do one game at a time. A young man said to me the other day, Sister Jean, we broke your bracket. And I said, keep breaking it. That's okay with me.
This is the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Rolling right along, are we? What happened to Bill Self there in Kansas and Duke, Coach? You're just blowing off the blue bloods? Is that what you're doing there?
I guess that is what I'm doing. Although, apparently, as we've been discussing, depending on who you talk to, Michigan's a blue blood, too, so I didn't cut them all out,
yeah,
I guess.
I mean, you ended it with Sister Jean this time instead of Kansas and Duke, because I really liked the fact that in the first hour when we played those, we heard Porter Moser and Bill Self essentially say the same thing, from the small Loyola school to Kansas, the one of the bluest of blue bloods. But, yeah, one game at a time. They weren't talking about Final Four at all. They were talking about we got Duke. We got matched up with Duke, and that's all we care about is winning one game against Duke. And I think that was a special game, by the way. Really, really. Did you watch it all, Jim?
I was in and out of that one.
That was one where you want to watch the Blue Bloods. Again, yeah. It was one versus two, and it was every bit the game that you would think it would be. A ton of ties, a ton of lead changes, a ton of little mini runs, but nobody going on a big enough run. I think Kansas's biggest lead was 7.
Yep.
Duke's biggest lead was 4. And for most of it was 3 or 2 or 1 or tied or back to 4 again for most of that second half. I mean, it really, really was exactly what you would want an Elite Eight game to be with a Final Four bid on the line. It was exactly what you would expect, especially from two programs, storied programs who live in the Final Four. Mike Krzyzewski, by the way, coming up just short in his bid to pass John Wooden for most Final Fours in NCAA history. So that would be something, and he'll get there, of course. I mean, did you see the recruit? I'm going to get to the NFL here in a moment, Jim, but did you see their recruiting class next year at Duke?
No.
Oh, my God. You talk about being loaded. They have so many five-star recruits who are locked into going to Duke next year. It's going to be one of the freshman classes for the ages. It's going to rival, according to some analysts, the Fab Five when they brought in that group, and it's going to rival Kentucky's from 4 or 5 years ago, whichever what year it was that they had that group. Was that the Carl Anthony Towns group? I don't remember exactly which Kentucky team because, you know, Calipari's been doing this for a while now. But Coach K has just an amazing group of all state and highest ranked players in the nation kind of thing coming in next year. So they'll get back and he'll have his time. And Grayson Allen won't be a part of it. Maybe people won't hate Duke quite as badly because you know the Duke haters were loving it. Again, I know you said you were coming in and out of it. But Grayson Allen took 2 threes on their second-to-last possession that they absolutely had to have one of those, and he was off all day. I think he finished like 3 for 11 or 3 for 12 from the floor, but he missed 2 threes on the same possession. He missed one. They got it back, found him in a corner wing again, and he missed another one, and he just could not buy one. Of course, he almost won it at the end of regulation. That was in the overtime, of course. But at the end of regulation, he had a little kind of a, you know, drive, dribble back out, reset, step left, step hard left, and then he kind of little runner. Yep. That he banked, and it rolled around. It looks like it was going to drop, but then it hit the backboard again, and then it rolled a little more. It looks like it's going to drop before going off. And it was, oh, my God, talk about drama at the end of regulation. Grayson Allen almost won it for the Dukies, but the Grayson Allen haters, of course, were cheering because he was, you know, he wore kind of the goat horns. I mean, here's the other thing weird about that Blue Blood game, and I'm spending way too much time on it, but I have never seen so many collective airballs, maybe ever, in this high profile of a game. You know, this wasn't a preseason, you know, classic, you know, November classic someplace, a tournament where there's a handful of teams and everybody's getting their sea legs under them and they're trying to, you know, work their way into midseason form and yada, yada. At a high leverage game, Elite Eight status, Kansas and Duke just traded air balls or balls that didn't find the rim, you know, sometimes clanging off the backboard, drawing no iron. A lot of it was in the first half, but it was even late. We air balls on layup attempts. Now, not, you know, uncontested layup attempts like where you run on the floor in a fast break, but, you know, spin moves, post-ups to inside guys who were turning around and trying to make, you know, spin move layups with their left hand that were coming up short air ball style. I mean, some really, really crazy stuff going on. Bagley Jr., who had a great game for Duke, but he had a few of those in the second half. Jumpers that were air balls. Both teams just felt like, I don't know, you know what I was just talking to Anthony Broome about when he was saying Wagner seemed like he might have been just a little too hyped up for the game against Florida State for Michigan?
Mm-hmm.
And I just kind of surmised, and this is just the basketball coach in me, because and player, anybody who played the game, even at the high school level, knows you can't be tight. You can't be tense and shoot jumpers. You have to be smooth. Your muscles have to be relaxed. You have to be in a flow. You ever hear of, you know, you hear about being in rhythm, catching a shot and shooting in rhythm? You can't be in rhythm when you're just tense and tight and grit your teeth. And I think that both teams, Kansas and Duke yesterday, they knew who they were and they knew who their opponents were and they knew the magnitude of this because they play in the tournament against one another, maybe not always in the round of eight, but you know, at some point regularly. And they knew the intensity of this matchup. And I think both teams were just gripping it so tight. They're just letting it slip out of their hands without getting that smooth rhythm and that smooth flow. And both teams were just shooting tons of air balls. And again, I don't know how much you were in and out of that,
I did see a couple of them. No matter how much you were in and out, yeah, it was both sides, and yeah. You're definitely right about that. A couple of little numbers to throw at you. First for you, Grayson Allen haters: 3 of 13, 2 of 9 from downtown in that particular game. And you mentioned something about you were trying to think, which Kentucky team was it? Was it 14-15 Kentucky? Because I'm looking at it right now, and I see Carl Anthony Towns, Devin Booker, Willie Cauley-Stein, Trey Lyles on the team.
That was the one where they just had an incredible freshman class, and a lot of them were one-and-dones, obviously.
They lost in the Final Four to Wisconsin in that one.
Yeah, and who was their class when they won it in 2011? Or I'm trying to remember exactly.
I got to go back to this. It was like 2012 or something like that. Let me
we
check.
Know Louisville won it in 2013, cheating Michigan out of its title. Now that's why Michigan has its de facto. We are the de facto 2013 national champions. Louisville cheated. Vacating wins. Of course, Michigan will never be recognized as such, but that's terrible.
Yeah, it was 11-12's Kentucky team, and that had
give me those names:
Anthony Davis, Michael Kidd-Gilchrist, Darius Miller, Marcus Teague.
Oh my gosh, yeah. I mean, he's had some teams, you know. But I'll tell you what, not to get off the topic too much, but in all seriousness, Calipari has underperformed.
Yeah.
Based on the talent that he's a tremendous recruiter, maybe the best recruiter, and possibly because he's a cheating recruiter, looking at his history in other places where he has been, including UMass and including Memphis. But he brings them in like nobody else, or like as well as anybody else, but winning only one title with them, I got to tell you, he doesn't get enough out of them, in my opinion.
Well, this is one of those drawbacks that I think many, not just us, but others have brought up in the over the years of the one-and-done discussion. When you have, even if they're five-star guys and immensely talented, at the end of the day, they're still basically all freshmen.
That's right.
And that comes into play in specific situations, as we've seen time and again at these tournament times.
Yeah, that's exactly right, and that's why we've seen these teams that are more, again, not mid-major in that, like their MAC,
right.
Mountain West or something or whatever, but middle of the pack power conference teams that are keeping kids for 3 years, 4 years, playing together, and the top teams from some of the other, you know, like the Loyolas from some of the other non-power conferences. But they're keeping their guys together, and there is something to be said. If you have 5- and 4-star players playing, you know, who have been there only 1 year together, playing teams that are 3- and 4-star players, you know, so just a hair below, but have been there for 3 or 4 years together, suddenly upsets are not as rare. They're not as rare. They're more commonplace. And that's kind of what I think we saw play out a lot of this tournament, and I think it's going to continue to be the case until something changes at the professional level with respect to who can come and who can go. So anyway, yeah, if anybody has a number, by the way, call us. A number of air balls shot in that game. I told you I was in the car for some of it. So, and same thing with Michigan game. I was in the car for some of that too. So I had to rely on the radio announcers. But the radio announcers at one point halfway or so through the first half said, we're going to have to start keeping track of the air balls because it's so many. I mean, you know, the play by play, it comes up short air ball. And it's like, wow, it's like, that's not just like a coincidence. That's not like the second one of the half now. It's like the sixth one of the half. It might have been 3-3 or 4-2 between the teams. And again, I saw it happening in the second half as well. So I don't know if anybody actually ever tracked the air balls or they didn't. But they said, you know, the announcer was kind of like joking. And I don't know if any of the stat crew said, yeah, we'll do it. We'll count them because I'd like to know how many they finished up with because it was a ton of air balls. There were air balls all over the place. There's an actual air ball meme floating around the internet right now with Oprah. You know how Oprah did the you get a car,
right? Yeah.
You get an air ball. You get an air ball. That's how prevalent they were in that game. Air balls for everybody because that's how it was going. So I just don't know what the end total was. Okay, now pivoting to the NFL, as I said that I wanted to do, some very important issues to be discussed. Three of them. When the NFL owners get to their meetings this week, the NFL owners will meet And they're going to discuss two very important rules, and one that has nothing to do with rules. It has to do, of course, with supporting the game and the country, of course, which allows people to play in this game for millions of dollars. We'll start with the rules. The pass interference rule. According to ESPN and Kevin Seifert at NFL Nation, the proposal to change the NFL's defensive pass interference rule to a 15-yard penalty college style rather than a spot foul does not appear to have enough support to pass this week at the league's owners' meetings. New York Giants corner John Mara said he was one of the few competition committee members to support the proposal, which originated with the Jets. The committee did not endorse the rule as a sign that it would be difficult to rally at least 24 owners to support it as required by the NFL rules. I don't think anything will happen on that, Mara said. I happen to be in the minority. I prefer the 15-yard penalty, but more people prefer the current rule. What I want to know is who and why. And if you have an answer, 866-240-1065, if you think the better rule is 15 yards from the line of scrimmage on a pass interference down the field that could cost somebody a 60-yard gain or a touchdown, I would like to hear from you. I have not heard anybody make a relevant, cohesive argument that would tell me why you should reward defenders who interfere with, you know, players that are about to burn them on a 60-yard touchdown bomb by saying, I'll take the 15 and put you back there. I'm not going to let you just, you know, catch this touchdown pass. They're going to be tackling guys in the secondary. They're going to be tackling guys on bombs rather than let them take a chance on letting them catch it. I think that's one of the dumbest things I've ever heard. Why is there any support for this, Kush? Have you heard something that I'm not aware of as to why anybody would be supporting this? And it looks like, well, here's the update. Cowboys executive Stephen Jones, also a member of the competition committee, said members voted within the against the proposal within the committee 6-2. So it's an 8-owner committee.
Okay.
And 6-2, only the Giants and the Jets owners supported this. So that's an indication that they're going to have a hard time convincing 24 owners to change it,
yeah,
which is what it would take for this to happen out of the competition committee. Let's see. The Jets proposal would make all defensive pass interference fouls a 15-yard penalty unless the contact is intentional and egregious. Oh, now we're going to ask officials to determine what was intentional and what was egregious.
Oh, Lord.
Now we're going to ask them to say, he went up there trying to get the ball, but this guy went up there intentionally really to hit him and knock him over before he could make the catch. Ugh. Oh, my God. Asking them to discern intent.
Yeah, that.
By guys running, you know, full speed down the field. You know, running 4-3-40 side by side, going to try to determine whether that shove was a play on the ball or an intentional push to decide whether it's a spot foul or a 15. Give me a break.
Yeah, there's no way that part of it will end well.
That stipulation would presumably lessen the incentive for defensive backs to commit a foul in order to avoid. No, it won't. No, it won't. They're just going to become better actors.
Yep.
I mean, seriously, you know what it is, Jim? It's like a flop. You know, it's like in the NBA. It's like a flop. I'm going to make it look like I'm going to become a good actor that he really clobbered me as I just kind of give up my body strength and fall to the ground. That's what they're going to do, become better actors. I'll give you another one. When I played college football,
mm-hmm,
I was a tight end, and we had a pick play. Every team has multiple pick plays, which, as you know, are illegal. But from the tight end spot, I would have the flanker to my left, to my out, if I was on the left side, to my outside, and I'd be running an out.
Okay.
And my job was to intentionally run the out into the guy that's covering the flanker as he's running a slant. And what did I have to do? I wasn't allowed just to hit him. I had to look like I was just part of my pass pattern. So as soon as I got anywhere near him, I had to swing my head around, look at the quarterback, and put my hand in the air as I knocked him over.
Do the nice acting as if the ball's coming and you're about
exactly
to catch it. Yep.
Well, even if it's not coming, I'm waving my arm saying, I'm open, throw me the ball. Oh, it was inadvertent contact when I knocked that guy down, allowing my flanker to catch the slant for the touchdown.
Right.
You know what? Stop trying to reinvent the wheel, NFL. Stop it. They're just going to become better actors. Second, defensive backs, safeties, and quarterbacks are going to find a way to knock guys over and not make it look like it was intentional, and making sure it's only a 15-yarder instead of the spot foul for, you know, the ball on the 1-yard line because of a foul in the end zone.
Yeah, it's funny. This has come up a whole bunch of times, and you know, I personally never really had thought which side of it I really, really fall on. Although, as I've been thinking about it more, and really thinking about the differences when you have the deep ball in either the college or the NFL game. You get the deep ball, and then you get that penalty. And it's just so stark, the differences, that I can see why some on the NFL side want to do this. They're tired of
having it. Why? You haven't explained
it. It's only their
yet.
Defensive guys. It's the defensive side that, well, I'm tired of having a pass interference play that suddenly becomes first and goal at the one. But you know what?
But that's
the 15
point.
Yards doesn't do enough either.
If you're stopping somebody from scoring a touchdown because you know you've been toasted on a double move,
yep.
Why shouldn't they get the ball right where you interfered with him? Because he was going to catch it, and you were going to be, you know, you were going to be toasted. Why would you give him the benefit of we're going to go back 40 yards
exactly,
and just give him a 15-yard penalty the way they do in college? I've never understood that. I will never understand that.
No, and for me, as I've been thinking about it more and really thinking in the context of, okay, are they actually going to change this and make this a 15 or a 20-yard penalty or something? And
I'm
the more
I'm looking
I
for somebody
and,
to explain it to me and
right.
what their argument is on that side of it. Nobody's done it yet. You didn't just now.
No, I wasn't even trying to. If anything, I was just trying to speculate as to why anybody on the NFL side would be for that change. And the only thing I could think of is salty defensive guys, honestly. Because the more I think about it, the more I'd rather have it be the NFL rule than the college rule.
Yeah, it ought to be. It ought to be at the college level and the high school level, too. You screw somebody beyond 15 yards and pass interference, stopping a great play from becoming a big gain because you got toasted. Well, you deserve that foul right there. By the way, according to Troy Vincent, the executive vice president, the rule proposal has long been considered highly unlikely in part because of what I said. I like when things that I say are proven right by other people. In part because of the new level of judgment levied on officials to determine intent and egregious intentional and egregious contact. Exactly what I was just saying. You cannot ask them to look inside the minds and determine the intent of somebody.
You can't. There's already a couple things that are on that level. I don't want to burden them anymore with deciding, that 50-yard pass interference play? Was that intent? Am I going to give him another 10 yards or something? I don't even want to open that can, but it sounds like
If you want to do something really, really bold, if there is an argument to be made by not making it a spot foul, it would have to be really bold. And I would say find a number like maybe 30.
Okay.
And make that the line of demarcation. If a pass interference call is made beyond 30 yards down the field, they can make it, instead of a spot foul, a 30-yard penalty. You give 30 yards from the line of scrimmage. It's a 30-yard passing gain.
If they were ever going to change it, that was always this kind of angle is always where I would have wanted to see them go if they were insistent upon changing it.
You can't just do it with 15. It would have to be, like I said, that's why I'm just kind of issuing just I just made it up here about 30. I just think
a good number, because whenever I've thought about it and think, if you're insisting on changing it from spot foul to something, then I've always said that if you're going to do that, because of the number of plays that happen in this situation, 15's not enough. It's got to be at least 20.
Like I said, and to me, it just depends on where the interference occurs.
Right.
Now, if the interference occurs on a 15-yard out route, and there's interference, if he gets there before the ball gets there, you don't give them 30 yards. Then you just give them the spot foul.
Right. If it's under 30, you give them spot foul. Over 30,
you limit the gain to 30.
Right.
Now, it's still unfair because if somebody's throwing a 75-yard bomb for a touchdown, and it's coming back to a 30-yard gain, it still sucks. But at least it's a bigger penalty on the defense than just a 15 would be. You give them a much bigger incentive to make a play on the ball the right way rather than commit that interference.
Absolutely, because defensive pass interference on a deep ball is the worst penalty you can suffer as a team in football.
Correct.
Because of how much you can get. It could technically, potentially be a 90-yard penalty. I'm just theoretically speaking, but technically that could happen.
I mean, I don't know if anybody can wing it that
right,
far.
Right, right.
Yeah, wherever it happens to be. Troy Vincent, by the way, did say last week that the idea had gained momentum among some committee members and coaches who want to avoid the long, game-changing penalties. Of the 303 defensive pass interference penalties in the 2017 season, 129 were marked off more than 15 yards. So, to me, I think you've got to let it stay because it's the only way to
stop. Actually, wait, read those numbers one more time.
303 defensive pass interference penalties were called. 129, so less than half of them were marked off more than 15 yards.
So
most of them, you know, spot foul penalties, most of them were inside of 15. Like I said, they were curls or they were stop routes or they were outs or they were, you know, crosses or drags or whatever the case might be.
By my quick calculator calculation, that's 42.5% of the pass interference calls are of this deep ball variety. That's almost that's closing in on half. Yeah.
And that's not even saying it's deep ball variety. It just means more than 15. This could have been a 20-yard post in a flag or a post corner.
Exactly. So you in fact, I'm glad that you had those numbers because I was thinking the percentage would be closer to a third as opposed to a half. Yeah, you can't change it like that if almost half of them are of that kind of variety.
I just don't know why. I just want to know who these committee members are who and coaches who, quote, want to avoid long game-changing penalties. If your defensive player is robbing the offensive player of making a game-changing touchdown catch, well, then there damn well ought to be a game-changing penalty for it. you just changed the game by not allowing a touchdown catch to happen by interfering with the dude, but we're going to go back and make it just a 15-yard penalty.
Here,
so the game isn't changed.
You know what?
How the hell do you argue that if you're in that committee? I don't get it.
Good call, and on that note, it makes me think of a hypothetical example from a college game. So you're at the 40, your own 40, and you do one of these deep going for the home run ball plays. The interference is, let's call it, at the 5-yard line. I'm just spitballing here. But in college, that's 15 yards. So now you're at the 40, and now you're at the other team's 45. I can't tell you how many times in those hypotheticals I've seen that team that gets the penalty, gets moved up, get 0 points out of
that
because they don't even get into field goal range or something.
Yeah, that's very true, too. So it's just that's what's not right about it. Okay, shifting or moving or staying with the NFL but moving into one of the other big issues that they're going to be dealing with in the league owner meetings. Troy Vincent, again, the vice president of football operations for the league, talking, and I want to play this clip, about the catch rule. You know, we oftentimes call it the Calvin Johnson rule. We have seen it rob guys like Dallas's Dez Bryant, like Pittsburgh's Jesse James, nearly robbed an Eagles receiver with a touchdown in the Super Bowl. This ridiculous surviving the ground football move after the catch nonsense. How are they going to fix this? This is at least some of the discussion. Here's VP Troy Vincent.
Troy Vincent, head of game operations. Tell us what the competition committee has recommended regarding the new catch rule.
Well, the competition committee over the last, frankly, since the week after the Super Bowl, we've been reviewing more and more video, and in particular, three plays over the last, say, 5 or 6 years that has gotten fans on one side of the fence and coaches and
players.
What
are those plays?
So Jesse James. Okay. Just think about the Jesse James, the Calvin Johnsons, the Dez Bryants, and actually the Calvin Benjamin. So when we look at those plays and we went back and started to say, forget what the current rule is. Would you like for this to be a catch? And then we just tore up the old rule and they began writing slight movement of the ball, remove the term slight. So now you can still maintain, you can still have movement, but maintain control going to the ground. Rewrote that and the replay standard remains the same. So that's where we began by simply asking the catch committee. Then we went to the active players, then the coaches. Would you like for this to be a catch? Fan said yes, and then we wrote it. That's how the competition committee got to where they was for the playing rule proposal that they're putting on the floor.
I want to interrupt this conversation that we're replaying here to point out how incredibly brilliant and yet simplistic that is. There have been a number of people who have said for a long time, use the fan in the bar as your standard here. If a typical fan watching a game on a big screen in the bar sees a catch and cheers because he knows that's a catch, rule that a catch because your eye test has got to be, you know, the most important thing here. And that's what the official should be tasked with. What is his first instinct? What do his eyes see? Because he will never be allowed or able to break it down frame by frame to see if the ball moved in a receiver's hands on his way to the ground or while on the ground. Because just because a ball moves in the hand of the receiver on his way to the ground or while on the ground, it does not mean he lost possession of it. He didn't lose control of it. It never was in doubt as to whether he had it or someone else had it or nobody had it. It was his the whole time. And just because it may have, you know, been trapped between his hands and his chest, and when the momentum of his body hits the ground, it makes it come off of his chest and now is loose in his hands, but is still in his hands and in his general possession, that's a catch. And if the fans would say it's a catch in the bar, the damn league should recognize it as a catch in the officials, you know, in the official league offices and in New York when they review things and so on and so forth. So it sounds like, from what Troy Vincent just said there, that's what they're doing. Do fans, do players, do coaches, receivers want to see and say, yes, that's a catch? The answer is yes. Well, then, damn it, that's going to be a catch. That is about as simplistic and perfect of an idea that they could possibly have. Leave the game the way it has always been. I'm not saying don't use replay ever, but stop breaking it down frame by frame. Oh, I saw the ball come a little loose there as he took his last step out of bounds. Now the two steps, this goes back to the Super Bowl, now the two steps he touched inbounds don't count anymore because the ball is a little loose in his grip as he steps his third step, which is out of bounds on the catch. And now that's no longer a catch. That's the kind of crap that they do. And if the fans can figure it out, we know what a full catch is. When Dez Bryant makes that catch and stretches to try to get to the goal line, and then the ball hits the ground and comes out, whoa, he didn't survive the ground. Survive my butt. He caught the ball and was trying to make a play, and guess what? The ground cannot cause a fumble. The ground also sure as hell should not cause an incompletion.
As far as pass interference from a spot foul to a 15-yard penalty, there was momentum there. And I know NFL defenses were penalized 4,671 yards last year for pass interference. It's gone up in each of the last four seasons. It seemed like there was momentum there for a change. What happened?
I'm not sure. So it there was very good discussion in West Palm about why shouldn't we go to the college rule or adopt what they're doing in college? And I've been asked this question. I would say this. The difference between a college defensive back, because someone asked me my opinion about it, and a professional defensive back. A college player doesn't know when he's in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
Oftentimes, a college player doesn't know when he's beat until the officials signal a touchdown. The professional player, could strategize. There's so many different things. You can just grab. There's a bunch of things that comes into play. But I felt like it had some momentum. Even at the competition committee level, there were committee members who felt like this is the direction that we should be going.
On Wednesday morning, will there be discussion among the full ownership about this rule change?
We have 10 playing rule proposals, that, and this is one of the 10. Yeah.
Kill that one. Kill it with fire. Hey, don't forget this Thursday, our friends, remember the short code, 95819. Save that in your phone right now because it could win you $1,000 starting on Thursday at 9 a.m., noon, 3 p.m., and 6 p.m. It's the return of 4K a day. The winning starts Thursday right here on Toledo's sports leader, ESPN 106.5, The Ticket. All right, going to get a quick timeout, come back and talk about the flag and the anthem, which is also something that's going to be debated hotly and heavily at the owners' meetings this week as we continue right here on the Extravaganza.
Be part of the Extravaganza right now by calling 866-240-1065. Now back to the Bob France Extravaganza on 106.5 The Ticket.
Our final segment of this Monday afternoon right here on the Extravaganza. Don't forget drive time coming up at 5 o'clock. If you're easily offended by patriotism, love of country, and a belief in our flag, turn the radio off right now. If you believe in common sense and reality, then keep on listening because I'm about to lay the hammer down on a couple of people. The NFL owners are meeting this week, as you know, as we've discussed about a number of rules changes. One of the other things they're going to meet is they're going to arrive, according to multiple reports, very divided. Some owners on the side of keep the politics out of football, no national anthem protests will be tolerated. If you want to do that kind of stuff, do it on your own time. Others are going to show up saying let them do what they want to do. Knowing that the fan base is the customer, knowing that the fan base has expressed itself extraordinarily, overwhelmingly against said protests, it might be presumed that the owners who are against the protesting are going to win. I can only say that I hope so. Bob McNair is one of the most powerful owners in the league. He said, coming into the owners' meetings this week, that political statements have no place as a part of football Sundays. He said, and I quote, "We are going to deal with it in such a way that people will understand. We want everybody to respect our country and respect our flag. Our playing field, that's not the place for political statements. That's not the place for religious statements. It's the place for football. That's what we need to be doing, period." However, some owners, including the Johnsons duo, that would be Woody Johnson, who is the owner of the Jets, but is currently serving as an ambassador over in England in some capacity. So his brother, Christopher Johnson, who is very, very pro-player, protest in the stance, is speaking for him. Last year, well, first of all, he said that he believes that it would be a spectacularly bad idea to tell the protest or the protesting players that they cannot protest. He said also it would be a bad idea just to play the anthem while the teams are still in the locker room. He didn't say why, just said it would. No Jets players knelt during the anthem last season following Colin Kaepernick's lead, but Johnson stood with the players and locked arms every week. Johnson is running the franchise, as mentioned, while his brother Woody is U.S. ambassador to the U.K. Christopher Johnson's pro-player stance has endeared him to Jets players, and he was among the NFL owners who worked with the players to strike a deal on an unprecedented $89 million contribution toward a social justice platform. Let me just say this about that. And as I said, if you're easily offended, tough. I'm going to say it anyway. I want Chris Johnson, and I want any and every one of these players who thinks that what they're doing in what they believe as a nod towards social justice or fighting oppression or whatever other garbage idea or reason that they have, that they don't think that that is an insult to the country, that they don't think it's an insult to the national anthem and to our flag, then I would cordially invite them to take a tour this offseason. Tour other countries that play and work under other flags. And when you find one that will allow you the freedom to live and work and make millions and millions of dollars a year playing a game the way you can in free, liberty-loving, capitalist United States of America, then I suggest you apply for citizenship there. Because you know something? The United States, that flag, and that anthem, too many people have fought, bled, and died underneath it, protecting your liberty, protecting the greatest nation on earth that allows you to have your own opinions and doesn't lock you up for them, that allows you to work at playing a sport for millions and millions of dollars. There is no other place on earth in which you can throw a football 75 yards and make millions of dollars doing it. Not in Canada, not in the one or two other countries that have some semblance of football, not a chance. Nobody 6'6 and 325 is going to make millions of dollars blocking in countries where there's nobody to block for. This country has given you your opportunity to be rich, to be famous, and this country deserves to be respected. Now, if you don't think that your protests are disrespecting not only the memory of those who lost their lives, but the sacrifices of those who are still alive and who are wounded, who don't have legs or arms, who are blinded, whose sacrifices are too great for us to even comprehend, if you don't think this is an insult to them, ask them. No, it's not going to be 100%, because there are going to be some people who say, you know what, go ahead and do you. That's fine. But the vast majority of Americans recognize they don't have the liberties they have here in the United States in most other countries around the world. And in no other countries will you have the opportunity to pursue your craft in such a way as to make you a multimillionaire as you do here. Yes, you are offending the people of this country and its protectors when you want to bring your political ambitions onto the playing field. There is a time and a place for that. Do you know what that time and place is, players? The time is right now. The place is your local cities. If you think people want to hear you speak on systemic oppression as you see it, speak on police brutality as you see it, speak on the evils of capitalist America as you see it, if you think people want to hear you talk about how much better communist human rights violating Cuba is than the United States is, Colin Kaepernick, then let's find out right now how many people are willing to see that. Hold a special event, rent out Little Caesars Arena in Detroit, rent out Cleveland Stadium or Quicken Loans Arena in Cleveland, rent out the Oakland Coliseum out there in California. Go ahead. Let's see how many people come to see you when they know that's what you're there to speak on. Because that's the only way your speech is appropriate. Your speech is appropriate when people want to come and hear you speak on it. When you have a captive audience of 65,000 people that are in an arena that came to see you play football, to throw passes, catch passes, defend passes, sack people, run for touchdowns, that is the wrong time, because they're a captive audience there for something else. This is March. Speak on it, Cap, Bennett, Jenkins. Speak on it in your local cities in April and in June, or May and in June and July. And you can even do it in August if you want, as long as you do it outside the confines of your local stadium. Bob McNair is right. That anthem and that flag provide you the freedom to do all of the things that you want. What you should not do is subject people who did not come there to hear it to your own personal views. And that's where we're going to leave this. I am hopeful that Bob McNair and those owners are highly successful in shutting down all of this crap so we don't have to dance around it all season long in the upcoming NFL season right here on The Ticket. All right, good stuff. Thanks for being a part of the show. We'll cover more of the league meetings starting tomorrow. We'll have a little bit more on the tournament. And, of course, baseball starts on Thursday, so we got some really good stuff planned for you the rest of the week here. Stay where you are. Miller's next on Drive Time right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.